Picking up in our study in 2 John and in verse 7, 2 John and verse 7. I want to begin reading, though, from verse 4 and read down to that particular verse. It begins with a preposition. It simply means because. That's what the word for there means, because. It gives reason for what was just previously stated. Last Lord's Day morning, we had just finished verse 6. And I was trying to impress upon your minds that the subject matter that is being covered here by John in this short epistle is the same subject matter that he covered in 1 John. And he mentions commandments and commandment again, and we went back in 1 John and considered those last week. And I suggested to you that the commandments under consideration was to remember that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And the other commandment was to love one another. Same two commandments that John had spoken about in 1 John. And those two things are tied together in this text. Many people separate what has been said in the first six verses from what is said in verse 7 through the end of the book. But there is really no separation in the subject matter. The subject matter still continues. Even though it begins to talk about deceivers, we can take those deceivers back to 1 John. They're the deceivers mentioned in 1 John. They're the liars. They're the antichrist. They're the false teachers. They're the false prophets. And so the reason that he has mentioned in verse 6, love for one another, and mentions the word commandments, is because we're to remember that Jesus Christ is indeed the Son of God. We've had those two commandments from the beginning. As a matter of fact, one cannot become a Christian without belief in Jesus Christ as the Son of God. So 2 John, picking up in our reading in verse 4 in the New King James Version, I rejoice greatly that I found some of your children walking in truth, and we received commandment from the Father. And now I plead with you, lady, not as though I wrote a new commandment to you, but that which we have had from the beginning, that we love one another. This is love, that we walk according to his commandments. This is the commandment, that as you have heard from the beginning, you should walk in it. This is the commandment. Remember, the word commandment there has reference back to the commandment that we noted in 1 John. It consists of two parts. Believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and love one another. And then verse 7, where we pick up in our study, begins with a Greek preposition meaning because. So here's the reason that they keep the commandment to love one another and to remember that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. For many deceivers have gone out into the world who do not confess Jesus Christ is coming in the flesh. Now I hope you're able to see that. As he mentions Jesus Christ coming in the flesh, it's connected back to the commandment that is mentioned in verse 6. And that commandment, again, that we saw in 1 John. I just want to go back to 1 John. 1 John chapter 3. 1 John chapter 3, we'll pick up at verse 22. Because I want you to see the two commandments, but he also refers to them as a commandment. It is two commandments, but when they're put together, it is simply one commandment. And that's all that John is saying, and that's how he's using the word commandments and commandment in this passage, in 1 John and in 2 John as well. 1 John 3 and verse 22 again. And whatever we ask, we receive from him, because we keep his commandments, plural, and do those things that are pleasing in his sight. And this is his commandment. Now note, the word commandment is made up of two parts here. This is his commandment, that we should believe on the name of the Son Jesus Christ and love one another as he gave us commandment. As he gave us commandment? Well, there was two commands there. To believe on the name or on the person Jesus Christ as the Son of God, and the other commandment, to love one another. So he's giving two commandments, but then he refers to them as a commandment. Because one cannot believe that Jesus is the Son of God truthfully and honestly and not love his brethren. When one believes that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, then if he is faithful to that belief, he will love his brethren. One demonstrates his faith in Jesus Christ as the Son of God when he loves his brethren. So to keep one of the commandments is to keep the other commandment. It is an impossibility to keep one without keeping the other. If you truly believe that Jesus is the Son of God, then you will keep his commandment to love one another. And if you love one another, why is that? It's because you believe that Jesus is the Son of God. Now those same two things are mentioned in 2 John in verse 6 and 7. This is love, that we walk according to his commandments. Commandments plural. Now of course we want to take commandments there as all of his commandments. But in the context there are two commandments under consideration. One of the commandments is mentioned as being love, just in the previous verse, verse 5. And now I plead with you, lady, not as though I wrote a new commandment to you, but that which we have had from the beginning, that we love one another. There's the first part of that commandment. And then in the latter portion of verse 6, this is the commandment, that as you heard from the beginning, we should walk in it. Well, what commandment is this? Well, it's that which is mentioned in verse 7. For many deceivers have gone out into the world who do not confess Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. This is the deceiver and an antichrist. So, those are the two commandments under consideration. And the reason they're to love one another, the reason they're to keep the commandment that Jesus is the Son of God, because many deceivers, those who will mislead and beguile and lead people astray, teaching that Jesus is not the Christ, that he is not deity, that he did not come in the flesh. Many deceivers have gone out into the world. We mentioned this last Lord's Day morning too. They've gone out into the world. One would suppose that these deceivers, these antichrists, these false teachers were already in the world. No, remember back in 1 John, they were in the church. They went out of the church and now they're into the world. They've gone out into the world. It's always amazing that it seems as though the greatest enemies of God's people are those who start out in the church sometimes. They start out in the church, they abandon Christianity and fall away, and they become the greatest enemies of God's people. And so that's what had happened to these deceivers, these antichrists, these false prophets, these false teachers. For many deceivers have gone out into the world who do not confess, they do not acknowledge. Confess here means to, literally the word means to say the same thing. To say the same thing that God has said about his Son. God says that Jesus Christ is his Son. We confess him when we say the same thing. Literally that word confess, that's what it means. Literally to say the same thing. We acknowledge him. We accept him as the Christ, the Son of God. So this is a deceiver and an antichrist. So he says in verse 8, because of what he is, the warning that he has just given about the deceivers, he says, look to yourselves that we do not lose those things we have worked for, or you, some versions use, because of the Greek text, you have worked for. So look to yourselves. That word look doesn't mean to look with the eye. It carries the idea of beware. Watch out. He had just warned them about the deceivers. So watch out. Be on guard. Be alert. Take heed to yourselves that we do not lose those things we worked for. Now this is one of those passages that Calvinists wouldn't want you to read. Those things we worked for, because Calvinists don't believe we can do any kind of work in regard to our soul salvation. But here, it is evident that that which is under consideration is their eternal salvation. And they don't want to lose that which they have worked for. As Paul had told the Philippians, to work out their own salvation with fear and trembling. That's what John is telling them here. Don't lose that which you worked for. Well, what have they worked for? They worked for their eternal salvation. But if they come into contact with these deceivers who will beguile and mislead them, lead them astray into error, believing that Jesus is not the Messiah, that he's not Christ, not the Son of God, then they're going to lose that which they've worked for. They're going to lose their eternal salvation. So look to yourselves that we do not lose those things we worked for, but that we may receive a full reward, that we may receive a full, that is a complete or perfect, abundant reward of eternal life. That's what's under consideration by the reward. We're going to be rewarded with eternal life. So look to yourselves that we do not lose those things we worked for, but that we may receive a full reward. Verse 9, whoever transgresses and does not abide in the doctrine of Christ does not have God. He who abides in the doctrine of Christ has both the Father and the Son. So we see that what's under consideration here, again, is fellowship. That was one of the major themes, remember, back in 1 John. Back in 1 John, if one was of God, he was in fellowship with God. If one was of Satan, he was in fellowship with Satan. If one had seen God or known God, he was in fellowship with God. So having mentioned the deceivers and having mentioned in verse 8 the possibility of these to whom John was writing being lured away and deceived, led into error, he says, whoever transgresses and does not abide, there's that word abide in the doctrine of Christ. We saw that word abide over 30 times in 1 John. Remember, abide, continue, remain, dwell, sometimes even live. So the one who does not abide in the doctrine of Christ, whoever transgresses, that word transgresses is a Greek word that's made up of a Greek preposition from and a Greek verb meaning to go. So literally the phrase means to go from. To go from. So what have they gone from? Well, they've transgressed. They've gone, beyond. A Greek preposition beyond and to go beyond. So, what have they gone beyond? Well, they've gone beyond the bounds of scriptural authority. They've gone beyond the bounds of the teaching of God. Whoever transgresses and does not abide, does not remain, does not continue in the doctrine of Christ. I like to illustrate it like this, the idea of abiding and the idea of transgressing together. If you had a piece of land and you had a neighbor that didn't like you coming over on their land, then they might put up a fence, and on the fence they might put a sign that says, no trespassing. Well, when you go beyond that fence with a sign that says, no trespassing, what have you just done? Well, if you transgressed the law, you've trespassed. You've gone beyond the bound that has been set. You know, it's easy for children. If we say you only play in our yard, they understand that the yard that belongs to you and your family is the bounds, and they can't go beyond that. Well, that's the idea here. Whoever transgresses, whoever goes beyond, whoever progresses further than that which God has set, does not abide, does not remain, does not continue in the doctrine of Christ. Doctrine of Christ? It's not the doctrine about Christ. Some brethren want to say it's the doctrine about Christ. No, it's the doctrine of Christ. It's the doctrine that belongs to Him. It's the doctrine that comes from Him. It's the gospel of Jesus Christ that is under consideration. That's the bounds. That's the doctrine of Christ. We cannot, remember, add to it or take from it. If we have, we've transgressed. If we advance beyond, progress beyond, the progressives of our time period like to say, well, the word is old and outdated. We need to be progressive. We need to move on. We need to understand the word in the period of time in which we live. And if it means changing it a little bit to fit the time period, that's all right. No. John is a stickler for remaining in the old gospel. that which they had heard from the beginning, verse 5 and 6. So we don't progress beyond. We stay within the bounds of that which we've heard from the beginning. The old Jerusalem gospel. That's the doctrine of Christ. We remain in it. And anyone who goes beyond it simply does not have fellowship with God or Jesus Christ. That's what's mentioned in the latter portion of verse 9. Whoever transgresses and does not abide in the doctrine of Christ does not have God. What does it mean to have God? It means to have fellowship with God. To have God speaks of relationship, fellowship, and union. When we talk about having a wife, we're talking about having or sustaining a relationship with a wife. When we talk about one having a family, same thing. The idea of having a relationship, having brothers and sisters, so forth. So having God in the context is having fellowship with God. So the one who transgresses, the one who goes beyond, the one who progresses beyond the doctrine of Christ in regard to its teaching in the immediate context regarding who Christ is, in the gospel of Christ, in the doctrine of Christ, he claims to be the Son of God. Not only does he claim to be the Son of God, God himself affirms that he is his Son. When you go beyond that and say, well, he really wasn't the Son of God, you've called God a liar, and you have transgressed his will, you've gone beyond the doctrine which he has given of his Son. So he who abides in the doctrine of Christ, the one who remains and continues, the one who remains in the bounds of scriptural authority, you might say, has both the Father and Son. You have fellowship with both the Father and Son. It's impossible to have fellowship with the Father without having fellowship with the Son. To have fellowship with one is to have fellowship with the other. When you sever your fellowship with Christ, you sever your fellowship with God. We learn that in 1 John as well. So again, the same subject matter under consideration. So he's warning those to whom he's writing to, John is, a congregation, that if they transgress, go beyond the doctrine of Jesus Christ, they no longer will have fellowship with the Father and the Son. That means they will no longer receive a full or complete or an abundant reward of eternal life in verse 8. They will have lost all that they worked for. So the warning, stay away from these false teachers. Don't let them influence you, because the word deceiver means one who beguiles, one who leads astray. And that's exactly what they would do. And so in verse 10, in connection with that, he says, if anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, do not receive him into your house nor greet him. Now this verse has been twisted and distorted by many in different ways. One way is that some will say, well, if one comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, do not receive him into your house. And someone comes knocking on your door, maybe from a denominational church or maybe from the Mormons or some of those, and you say, well, you don't have the doctrine of Christ. I can't receive you into my house. That's not what it's teaching. It's not what it's teaching at all. It's not teaching that you can't bring someone into your house and teach them the truth if they're in error. That's not what's under consideration.
James, the sad thing is that most members of the Church of Christ, if somebody comes to their door, Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses, they're going to tell them that they're not interested because they don't have the knowledge to teach them.
To teach them, yeah. A good thing to do if you don't want to invite them in is to have a tract available. You can give them a tract. They probably throw it in the trash, but at least you make some effort to try to get them to know the truth. Usually when you ask a Jehovah's Witness to read something that you have, they won't read it, because they only want to read that which Watchtower puts out. Their corporate headquarters. They simply won't read what you give them. They won't even read the same Bible you read. They want to read and study from their Watchtower translation. So usually it's pretty hard to get them to do anything in regard to looking truthfully at the Scriptures. But back in verse 10, if anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, do not receive him into your house. The idea is not that you can't bring someone in your house and try to teach them the truth. But some have used this passage to get out of trying to teach the truth. That which is under consideration, you have to put it back into the first century. Back in the first century. In the first century, there was itinerant preachers, those who traveled from place to place, preaching and teaching the will of God. And there were not a lot of hotels and motels for people to stay in. And people during this particular period of time would extend hospitality to those who were coming, preaching and teaching the Word of God. And extending hospitality to them was a good thing. We're going to learn that in 3 John, as a matter of fact. As Gaius would receive those itinerant preachers, preaching and teaching the truth that had come from John. But Diotrephes would not receive them. So that's what's under consideration here in verse 10. You have one who comes to your town or your village. He does not have the gospel of Christ. He does not have the doctrine of Christ. Now, how do you know? Well, implied in this is you're going to have to ask some questions. You're going to have to investigate a little bit. You're going to have to know what he is teaching, what he is propagating, what he is spreading. To receive him into your house is to extend hospitality to him. That's what's under consideration here. Let me use this example. I have some members of my family, some cousins that are Baptist preachers. There's not a problem for me having one of those cousins come to my house and sit down and have Thanksgiving dinner, or sit down and visit for a while if I haven't seen them for some time. Not a problem at all. I can extend hospitality to them like that. But suppose they come back after some time and say, "Well, it's good to see you. I'm going to be in town preaching a revival next week, and I want to stay here with you." I'll have to tell him, "No, you can't. No, you can't." Because what would I do? What would I be doing? I'd be sharing in his evil deeds. I would be giving him a place and extending hospitality and providing him food and comfort and all the necessities of life on this occasion so he can propagate and teach error. I'd be sharing in his evil deeds. And that's what's under consideration in this verse. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, do not receive him into your house. Don't extend hospitality to him. Don't do that. He says, nor greet him. The word and the idea expressed in the word greet here is to wish him well. The first example I used of my cousin coming and sitting down and taking a Thanksgiving dinner, a denominational preacher, not a problem. As a matter of fact, when he leaves, I could say, "Well, have a safe journey. Take care of yourself." But then the next time he comes back and wants to stay there and hold a revival at some denominational church in town, I can't so much as greet him. I can't say to him, "Be successful. Enjoy it. Hope you do well. Hope you prosper in your efforts that you're putting forth this week." No, I would be encouraging him. I would be encouraging him in the propagation of error, in the spreading of false doctrine, false teaching. That's the greeting that is under consideration. So don't extend hospitality to him, and don't encourage him in his work. And so verse 11 of 2 John, "For he who greets him shares in his evil deeds." Shares, a verb there in the noun form, simply means you become a partaker. Or a sharer. You participate with him, note this, in his evil deeds, in his evil works. What works? Well, the spreading and propagation of error. That's what's under consideration. So you become a sharer or a participant in spreading error when you extend hospitality to those who are in error and then wish them well and success in their endeavors in spreading false doctrine. We don't want to do that. And in the first century, there was a lot of that going on, you know. As I said, they didn't have motels and hotels. So, as the Hebrew writer said, in the latter portion of the book, show hospitality even to strangers. itinerant preachers would come who would be strangers. That is, they would be unknown to them. So they would have to find out if they were teaching the truth or not. In connection with the subject matter under consideration, perhaps one of the first questions that would be asked of an itinerant preacher who would come to your village or your town and you were going to extend hospitality to him would be, well, who is the Christ? Is Jesus the Christ? Is he indeed the Messiah? Is he God in the flesh? And if they said, no, he's not, then you would know right away that that I can't extend hospitality to you. Not at all. Verse 12, 2 John. Having many things to write to you, I do not wish to do so with paper and ink. Having many things to write to you. Remember, John is writing to some congregation. Which congregation, of course, we do not know. But he's got many things to write to them. But he does not wish to do it with paper and ink. Papyrus and ink. But I hope to come to you and speak face to face, that our joy may be full, that it may be complete, that it may be perfect. So I wish to do so, not with paper and ink, but I hope to come to you. So John is expecting to travel. I hope, remember the word hope here, desire plus expectation. He expects to see these to whom he's writing to in the future, and he has a desire to. But I hope to come to you and to speak face to face. This idea of speaking face to face, literally in the Greek here, it's speak mouth to mouth. Speak mouth to mouth. It's an old Hebrew phrase from the Old Testament, speak mouth to mouth. Of course, we don't use that kind of language to speak mouth to mouth, and so it's translated speak face to face. Speak person to person. That's what's under consideration. So he wants to come and he wants to speak to them person to person. He wants to speak to them face to face. He wants to be in their presence. That's what's under consideration. I hope to come to you and speak face to face. Why? Well, that, in order that, or so that our joy, so that our rejoicing will be made full or complete or perfect. The children of your elect sister greet you. The children of your elect sister greet you. Your elect sister? Evidently, John is at a congregation that he speaks of here in verse 13. The children of your elect sister. The children of this sister would be those who make up a congregation wherever John is at, where he's writing from. Some suppose that it's the church in Ephesus. I say suppose because we have no way of knowing where John was at when he wrote this epistle. But evidently, a congregation mentioned in verse 13 as the elect sister of the elect lady in verse 1. So it's a sister congregation. And the members of that congregation send greetings to the congregation to whom John is writing. That's what's under consideration here. The children of your elect sister greet you. Now, I had mentioned before that as John wrote the book of Revelation to the seven churches of Asia, Ephesus was one of those churches. Perhaps he was at one of the other churches. We simply do not know. But think about it. If John was at Ephesus, and many suppose that he spent his last years at Ephesus, just think about, and you go to Revelation and see what the Lord had to say about the church in Ephesus. Just think about the preachers who were at the church in Ephesus. Paul spent 3, perhaps plus years there, working with the church in Ephesus. Timothy was there for a period of time. And if in fact John was there, just think about that. The Apostle Paul and the Apostle John and Timothy, they all preached and worked and labored with the church in Ephesus. But just think, what happened to the church in Ephesus? You know, it was to the Ephesian elders that Paul spoke in Acts chapter 20. That even from the eldership themselves, there would be men arise that would speak perverse things. There would be false doctrine even arise in the church in Ephesus from the eldership. So, as I said earlier, many times those who become enemies of God arise and rise up in the church. They begin in the church, they forsake Christ and Christianity and fall away. Questions or comments about 2 John? The Epistle of 3 John, 14 short verses. It's much like much like 2 John. All of these were written perhaps about the same time, late in 64, early 65 perhaps. Now, there's something about 3 John that's a little different from 2 John, but I want to suggest to you that even though we see some difference in these two short epistles, they're written about the same time frame, and they could be connected with the same problem. The same problem. These false teachers, these antichrists, these false prophets who've gone out into the world. Because in this context, John is not writing to a congregation here in 3 John. He has written to the congregation, but doth refuse to receive it. So he writes to Gaius, evidently a member of this congregation. Now, in this epistle of 3 John, he also speaks about itinerant preachers, those who travel from place to place. Gaius would receive them, extend hospitality to them, but Diotrephes would not. So we see some connections between these epistles. Now, we don't know all of Diotrephes' problem. Why was he not receiving the Apostle John and some of these itinerant preachers? Was it because he thought they were teaching error? Or was it because Diotrephes was one of those in this congregation who had accepted the false doctrine and the error that was being spread? So now he's not receptive to those who are teaching the truth and trying to correct the error. We simply do not know. There's several things we do not know about this epistle and how it's connected to 1 John and 2 John, but it's evident in the context itself it is connected somehow. Four people mentioned in this short epistle, 14 verses, John himself, Gaius, the individual to whom it is written, and then Diotrephes, and then perhaps an itinerant preacher by the name of Demetrius. So those four individuals are going to be mentioned in this particular epistle itself. Gaius, there are three other Gaiuses mentioned. There's a Gaius of Derbe, Acts 20 and verse 4. Gaius of Macedonia, Acts 19 verse 29. A Gaius of Corinth, Romans 16, 23, 1 Corinthians 1, 14. Is this one of those Gaiuses? We have no way of knowing. As John writes to this individual by the name of Gaius, Gaius was a common name in the first century, like John, so there could have been a number of Gaiuses. So we simply do not know who this Gaius is. He could have been one of those earlier mentioned. Most likely he's just someone else with another name by the name of Gaius. The individual by the name of Diotrephes that's mentioned here, the name itself means nourished by Zeus, or foster child of Zeus, Thayer says in his Greek lexicon. Foster child of Zeus, or nourished by Zeus. That gives us some indication that Diotrephes may have been a Gentile. We do not know for sure, but there's a possibility simply because of his name. And he loves to have the preeminence, we're told in the text. That's a compound verb in the Greek that means to love and to have first place. To love and to have first place. So he loves to have first place among those members who make up the congregation and that he is a member of. We're out of time, so we'll pick up at the beginning of this short epistle and perhaps get through it next week. If we do not finish it next week, then we'll finish it the week after that. Thank you very much for your kind attention. We'll pick up here in 3 John with verse 1 next Lord's Day morning.